Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies. I'm Craig Servillo, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Dr. Pamela Sweat about her excellent book, Selling Under the Swastika, Advertising and Commercial Culture in Nazi Germany, published by Stanford University Press in 2014. Dr. Sweat, hello and welcome to the show.
Hi, Craig. Thanks for inviting me.
It's great to have you. Dr. Sweat, we normally like to begin these interviews by having you tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, I was born in Massachusetts. I went to Bryn Mawr as an undergraduate. And when I arrived at Bryn Mawr, I guess I knew I wanted to be a researcher, but I was sort of torn between chemistry and history. But when I got there, I happened to have some luck and chose some courses taught by the great Jane Kaplan, and those out there who are historians of Germany will know that name. And that did it for me. I never looked at another chemistry book again. So I worked at Bryn Mawr on German history and then went to Brown University for graduate work. At Brown, I got lucky again and chose Volker Berghahn as my supervisor, who has a terrific reputation as a wonderful supervisor. And so I had a good experience there, and Carolyn Dean was also an important teacher and mentor. So that's how I ended up doing what I'm doing. And then I got this job at McMaster University, and I've been in Canada the last 18 years or something like that. It's been a while now.
Oh, wow. I'm also from Massachusetts, so it's always nice to speak to a fellow a Massachusettsite.
That's right.
So fascinating. How did you come to write this book? What got you interested in this topic of advertising and commercial culture? It's not something that has been written about a lot, but very, very important and very fascinating.
Right. Well, I guess it goes back to when I was still a graduate student. As I mentioned, Volker Berghahn was my supervisor, and he never really let any of us idle too long. And so I remember it was all, you know, while I was writing my dissertation, which was on a completely different topic. It was about political radicalism in late Weimar Berlin. And one day in his office, when I was still sort of focused on that, he said to me, "So what is your next project going to be when this is done?" And that surprised me, but of course I didn't want to say I had no idea. And so I was sort of trying to brainstorm quickly. And I said, well, maybe something on consumer culture, consumption in Nazi Germany. And he said, well, you know, by the time you're actually working on this next project, that will probably have already been done. It was a field that was still, you know, kind of opening up at the time, but he assumed somebody would snap that up before I got to it. And maybe he was just saying this to kind of, you know, keep me on my toes and sort of encourage me to get thinking about it. But whatever the case, a few years later, when the dissertation was completed and the book manuscript was off to the press, I did start poking around in the general area of kind of consumer culture and in the Third Reich, and then ended up settling on advertising as the focus. I think there could have been other things one could have done, because I think I was right in this instance, which is unusual with Volker, but it wasn't a completely well-trodden area at that point. But anyway, I settled on advertising, and I think perhaps the reason was, as you said, nobody had done it yet, but also I liked the fact that it kind of offered a new way into issues of consumer culture, but it seemed to me it spoke to some other issues as well. So of consent with regard to the dictatorship, daily life, commerce more generally. So it was even though in a way it's very narrow because, you know, you're looking at sort of one sector of you know, the sort of larger consumer culture, it gave me a way to sort of speak to a lot of issues that I was interested in. And so just to give you one example, one of the things I liked about it was there's sort of three types of actors in the story, right? There are your advertisers and business owners. That's sort of one group. And they have their own motivations, right? They're business people. They want to make a profit. They want to sell stuff. Then you've got your consumers, right? And they are women for the most part. So that sort of brings in an interesting issue. Plus, they have different motivations, right? They want good quality products, or they want to feed their family, or they're worried about, you know, a health concern, they're looking for medicine, or whatever the case may be, but they have their own personal issues that motivate them. And then, of course, in this case, given this is a dictatorship, you also have the state with its own sort of intentions regarding consumer or commerce generally. And so I like the idea of trying to think about these three different sort of groups of historical agents and how they will negotiate this the same space, right? The same sort of visual culture and commercial space. And it turned out to be fun. So I stuck with it.
it definitely sounds, when you read it, it definitely comes through as a fun project to work on. So let me ask you, I know the book is about the Third Reich, but can you talk a little bit about advertising in the Weimar period? And how does it change when the Nazis come to power? Is the change abrupt or is it gradual? Anybody barely notice?
Right. Yeah. Sure. I mean, like other aspects of Weimar, the advertising industry was hobbled by the economic crises at the start and the end of the Republic's lifespan, right? So there's going to be this, you know, a crisis within advertising sort of at the start and then again during the Great Depression. You know, when companies aren't seeing profits, they tend to cut back on expenses that aren't seen as vital. And this is true today, obviously, as well. And advertising is an easy thing to spend less on, right? So that's one of the first things that tends to go, or at least, you know, can be minimized. I think this was especially true in the 1920s because there was a tradition in Germany going back into the 19th century that advertising was a little bit shady, right? It was not a respected sort of industry. A lot of business owners, commercial leaders believed that if one's products or services were good, you know, the quality was high, then you didn't need to advertise, right? That the word of mouth would be enough. And that if you had to advertise, that was almost a sign of desperation. You had to, you know, try to almost trick people into buying your goods or services. And this is connected to sort of longer standing, you know, anti-Semitic beliefs and prejudices as well, and which I'll come back to. As you can imagine, that will come back into the story when the Nazis come to power. But anyway, so because advertising was already kind of in this liminal position, that was a further reason to kind of cut it during time, you know, difficult economic times. So we're not going to see the industry in Weimar develop, you know, to a huge extent, right? It's kind of struggling along through the Weimar period for these reasons. But, you know, its best years, like in other aspects of Weimar history, were the sort of middle years, you know, say 24 to 28, the sort of most stable years economically. And the first thing that's worth stressing when we look at that period, for example, is that advertising is really, there's kind of two worlds of advertising in this period. Most advertisement, most product promotion was very simple. Small print ads, signs, black and white, no photographs, just some, maybe a drawing, or just some simple type, you know, that lists sort of the name of the retailer or the name of the company, what they make, where they're located, you know, what we might think of today almost as classifieds, right? So very small, simple print ads. And that's what most advertising. That's the bulk of sort of the promotional material that's out there. You might get sort of, if you move up in terms of the size of the company, say a large retailer like a big department store in one of Germany's main cities, they might have an in-house ad department or an in-house ad, copywriter, designer. Those classifieds, those small retail shops and stuff, their ads are being farmed out to freelance designers. So maybe a larger retail outlet like a department store, they might have a couple of people within house that design all the ads. But theirs therefore might be slightly more sophisticated, but still quite simple. Only the sort of largest companies, sort of the international companies in Germany might actually go to an ad agency. So ad agencies, the way we think of them, are really in their infancy in these years. And the most sophisticated in Germany are actually branches of American and British agencies, like J. Walter Thompson is one of the three or so that I talk about in the book. These are quite sophisticated operations, but therefore they're very expensive. So only the biggest sort of brand names are relying on these agencies, and many of their customers, many of the companies who go to these agencies in Germany in the 1920s are actually, as I said, international corporations, including, say, American companies who want to sell their goods in Germany. So General Motors, for instance, is one of the companies that relies on an ad agency within Germany in these years. But a lot of, all the small German companies are not doing that. Now, having these non-Germans on German soil making ads, we do see in the 1920s some change, some sort of a greater sophistication across the industry. You might say there's an Americanization of the look of ads in this period. And this is something that Victoria de Grazia, among others, has written about. And that is that, for instance, we see in the 1920s the emergence of what we might call teaching ads. So this was a style of ad that had been created first in the United States, and then it sort of makes its way to Germany in the 1920s. And by teaching ad, what they mean is that the advertisements for the first time have more text, and this text, a whole paragraph or so, instead of just the name of the company and where they're located and what they make, a sort of paragraph or two teaching the consumer why they should buy this item. So they might try to present some scientific evidence for why, buying a certain toothpaste will help, cut down on cavities. Or they might, describe why using Odol mouthwash will, improve your breath and therefore make you more kissable. Right. So these sorts of attempts to, through text, to convince the consumer to make a purchase. And this is quite new, and as I said, it comes first from the United States, but we start to see it popping up in Germany in the 1920s. We also see advertising becoming more international in other ways, right? The graphics, the typeface that's being used, all of this is sort of influenced by international trends. And the whole sort of industry is quite international in the 1920s. So not just Germans, but Americans and British, and they're traveling to other countries to learn about advertising and graphic design. They're reading each other's professional journals and this sort of thing. And there are some German advertisers who are actually quite involved in this sort of international climate. And so the look of advertising. Does become more sort of international in the 1920s. But as you might imagine, therefore, this is going to kind of come back to haunt them in the Depression. So that when the Depression comes at the end of the decade, this sense that advertising is international is a disadvantage, right? When Germany becomes more nationalist, as the Nazis are kind of making their quest for power, and as the democracy, the republic's democracy is faltering, there's this kind of inward-looking nationalist spirit, and therefore advertising is kind of not, not on that trend, and so there's a sort of backlash against advertising. And some of those older arguments against advertising come to the surface, right? That this is actually a Jewish practice, a Jewish business practice that is really about tricking consumers or hoodwinking consumers into buying things they don't need and, you know, should be rejected. So advertising in the years right before the Nazis come to power is really in a defensive position. They are seen as foreign to many within Germany as, you know, led by Jews or at least sort of representing a kind of Jewish international business model. So that's certainly not going to help. And also the fact, of course, that the economy is struggling means that, you know, when companies are looking to trim their bottom line, they also are going to maybe cut back on advertising. So advertisers, say, you know, from 1929 to 33 or so, are really feeling very concerned about their futures, you know, very defensive, as I said, about what they do. Now, for some, this made the Nazis kind of attractive. And although that doesn't seem to make sense, it kind of does if you think about it, right? If you feel like the whole, say, society is against you and you need to, you know, maybe you're not going to have your job in a year, if there is a political party that says, well, yes, you need to be reformed, but there is a place for you in the future, you know, you might at least listen to what they say. And so when the Nazis come to power, there were at least some advertisers who said that we should give this new regime a chance. And the reason why they thought maybe we should give the new regime a chance is because, remember, the Nazis had a very high reputation for their own graphic design and their own sort of product promotion being themselves, right? Promoting their ideology, their party. They were thought to be very good propagandists. And so, you know, advertisers thought, well, these are people who understand what we're all about. They understand, you know, what good promotion means, and they understand modern media, and they, you know, the Nazis had been very adept at using newspapers, using film, using radio, et cetera, right? So they seem to have a good grasp of modern media and communications and propaganda. And so there were at least some advertisers who thought, okay, these guys maybe will like what we do because they respect it. Now, there were certainly other advertisers who, you know, were not on board with the Nazi takeover. You know, there was a sort of significant number of Jews in the industry, also socialists and others who just had this more international mindset, who did not like this turn inward that the Nazis represented. So it's really, everything is sort of up in the air by the end of the decade. You know, so I wouldn't say there was really an abrupt change, but there are changes, right? So when the Nazis come to power in 1933, they do say that, you know, advertising should remain, that advertising has its place in, you know, the commercial world, but it does need to be reformed. They insisted on already within the first year. So if you think about the sort of time frame here, trying to judge whether this is abrupt or gradual, you know, the Nazis come to power in late January 1933. By March, the propaganda ministry has been formed, and by the end of the summer, the what is known as the Ad Council, or the Deutsche Werberat, the sort of Nazi Ad Council, is created. And so this is the body that will govern all advertising. It was a body that answered to the propaganda ministry, or sort of Joseph Goebbels' ministry. But it wasn't really directly under him. He was kind of a semi-official organization. It's not really a party organization. It had kind of a strange existence. It was mostly, if you look at the Ad Council and the actual people who served on it, there are some party officials, but the bulk of the members are actually business people, sort of leading businessmen. And so, yes, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to ask, did Goebbels interfere or meddle with this board?
Right. Yeah, well, he had the power to, and he, but he doesn't really. I mean, I think that was one of the interesting things that I found. As we move into the sort of mid-1930s, Goebbels is, he doesn't meddle with it too much. And when he does, it's not to be, we don't see him really pushing them to be, stricter in any sense. He's, for the most part, on board with their view of advertising, these businessmen. And so what was their view? Well, they had the ability to censor ads, right? They could tell a company, no, that ad can't run. They rarely do that. And I think that's because, again, when we look at who they are, they're business people and they want companies to survive. They want their own companies to survive. So in general, the profit motive does not disappear. And Goebbels himself had kind of an interesting relationship with the whole sort of realm of consumer culture. He believed Germans should have a good standard of living. He believed Germans should enjoy themselves, should have entertainment in their lives, should have pleasure in their lives. How the regime would achieve this in an economy that was still, was still quite weak in terms of consumer culture, that's a more complicated issue. For the most part, Goebbels and those around him, and Hitler and those around him, all believed that, prosperity would only come for Germany, real prosperity, and an abundance of consumer goods would only come after the victory in war that they were planning. So we're not going to see a huge growth in consumer goods within German society in the 1930s, but they're not against the idea, so they don't do a lot to shut down advertising or consumer goods industries on principle. They are sort of dampening that side of the economy in order to prepare for war. But not just sort of on principle that, Germans shouldn't have things, right? They weren't against that. They just wanted, their focus was on preparing for war first. So the Ad Council, does go about reforming, in their words, reforming the industry, right? They will purge the industry of Jews and so-called, enemies of political enemies. So those who had former links to parties of the left, will not be able to get licenses to work as advertisers. So we see thousands of people actually being pushed out of the industry. And the industry is quite large if you think about all the types of jobs that might fall under, the term advertising. So it's not just copywriters and ad and designers, but, photographers and, people who write jingles, people who design signs, window dressers, et cetera. There's lots of different types of people connected to advertising. So, yeah, we see thousands of people getting pushed out. But in terms of the sort of content of ads or the look of ads in terms of design, we're not going to see hugely, obvious changes. They are subtle, I think. And that's, the Ad Council was okay with that. Again, they wanted businesses to survive. They were business people. And so there's not a huge push to make ads really Nazi in any kind of very explicit way. And let me give you an example or a couple of examples. One, you may have heard this already, but the leadership of the regime was very concerned about sort of health of the people, right? That this was a priority. And so there were a variety of laws put into place over the years that tried to limit smoking, tried to encourage people to drink less alcohol, et cetera, eat better, get exercise, all this kind of thing. And yet, although it was discussed, there is no ban put on cigarette ads and there are no bans put on ads for alcohol. So they certainly considered it. They knew that was a possibility and that it would probably help achieve this ideological goal. But they don't do it. And there's no pressure from, so the ad council doesn't do it, and there's no pressure from Goebbels' office or anybody else to do it. So again, there's like, you know, they're trying to sort of strike a balance between consent, you know, getting the population to be happy, and their own ideological goals. So, you know, that's one example in which they certainly could have used ads to achieve an aim that they decide not to do.
Reasons that they don't interfere with the advertising industry similar to why they don't interfere with other industries, that they try to cultivate sort of strong relationships with big business? And is that one reason why they just sort of they encourage but don't
right.
force them to,
yeah.
to not
suffice? Yeah, I mean, suffice. I think so. Mm. Yeah, I think so. So we do see, just like, you know, just as you're saying, that for the most part, they are not going to be that coercive with companies, right? They're not forcing companies to do much. They're indirectly forcing them to try to deal with an economy that is not very friendly to consumer goods industries, simply because they've, you know, limited the amounts of imports of raw materials that might be used in consumer goods industries, for example, as they try to prepare for war. But yeah, they're not going to be very coercive to companies, and that is because they want people to be on side, not just the consumers, but also business owners. I mean, I think they're probably less interested in these business owners than they are in heavy industry, right? Because of the war. But you're right. That it's the same sort of latitude given to business owners that, you know, in the consumer goods industries and in heavy industry. And I also think that they don't interfere for a couple of other reasons, or not as much as one might expect. One is that I think they feel they don't really have to. So, you know, put it this way, you think about what advertisers do, even today, right? That, you know, what they try to do is they try to kind of look around, see what the trends are, see what the zeitgeist is, you know, what are people interested in. They try to, you know, replicate that in their advertising. I mean, nowadays we even have certain advertisers whose job it is to anticipate trends, right, and to kind of create them, you know, be ahead of that, you know, moving fashion. But at this time, they're not quite that sophisticated, but they're certainly trying to pick up on, you know, what is popular right now, what is in the news, what's the buzz, right? And so if you think about the 1930s, well, National Socialism was the zeitgeist, right? National Socialism was what everybody was, you know, experiencing, feeling. That was the mood, right? That's what, you know, people were getting, you know, at least some were getting excited about, some maybe still a bit indifferent, but interested at least in what was going on. And as a result, that the ideology kind of seeps into the ads in certain ways without coercion, right? Because advertisers and business owners are trying to be, you know, in the right place at the right time, right? They're trying to think about, you know, how can they seem to fit into this new journey that is developing. So how do we see that in subtle ways then, as I said, in ads? Well, you know, we're going to see less of, you know, fewer ads for luxury, right? The luxury, you know, conspicuous wealth is less, you know, a popular way to represent yourself in this period. And so we see, you know, luxury and self-representations around wealth being less apparent in ads. We're going to see, you know, a greater sense, the opposite side of that, of kind of community, right? That, you know, ads for products that are supposed to improve, you know, a sense of togetherness, a sense of unity, or a sense of good health, as I said, sort of racial well-being in many ways. So this is subtle, but it's certainly there in the ads in this period. And therefore, I don't think the regime feels they really have to do a lot to coerce, because they're still getting ads that, you know, represent their ideals. Of course, we don't want to forget, you know, when I say they're not coercive, that's, you know, I already did mention that they have sort of eliminated thousands of people working in the industry, right? So that certainly is, you know, a significant form of coercion, and that certainly did happen. But after those people no longer hold their jobs, I think they felt that the ads that they were seeing in the news, you know, in newspapers and such were, and magazines, you know, did represent kind of, you know, the issues of the day.
Very interesting. You mentioned in your introduction the sort of three actors that mm-hmm. play in this book, the regime yep. itself, the consumer, and the advertising agency.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to talk a little bit about consumers, particularly women, and the role of women as sort of when advertisers are thinking about it. What are, you know, the role of the woman in purchasing things?
Right.
And how did the advertising industry view women, as opposed to how we know the Nazis viewed the mm-hmm. role of women? And you mentioned there was some compatibility between the regime and these agencies, mm-hmm. but wondering how women, thinking about women, sort of impacted both those other actors that you mentioned.
Right. Yeah. Well, advertisers were quite aware that women made the, you know, the bulk of the purchases for their family. For their families, and so they definitely will market to women. They are thinking of women, you know, as the audience for their advertisements. And there's also a push in light of this reality to get more women working in advertising. This happens already in the 1920s, but it does continue. Now, I'm not saying as leading executives or anything, which naturally remain quite rare, but as shop window decorators, as store in-store sales staff. And also a form of advertising that's kind of disappeared today is, you know, that women were often hired by consumer good brands to sort of demonstrate the products, right, to sort of do little demonstrations within stores or at, you know, party meetings or at, you know, in various places around cities and towns to get people to see what these products were all about and how they worked. And they would like to have women for those jobs as well, because they thought quite explicitly that, you know, women would trust, you know, female consumers would trust these women sales staff and you know, be more willing to believe what they were saying about why the product was good. So we are seeing more women sort of come into the industry at low levels. And, you know, so how does this fit with the Nazi view of the role of women? Well, you could argue that it makes sense that, you know, that National Socialists would be okay with this because it putting women in the role of, you know, caretaker to the family, you know, the consumer who provides, makes decisions, makes purchases for the family, and that, you know, that's her housewife, her role as housewife. Because a lot of the sort of working female sales staff would be single women. So this is, you know, before they get married, so that's okay because they'll still someday get married and be housewives. And so it all seems to fit, you know, well enough with Nazi ideology. But what I'd also say is that, and this maybe shows a little bit of tension between that idea that, you know, women are housewives, or at least are a sort of simplistic view of what that means, is that we also see in this period a greater attention to women as shoppers, but as rational shoppers, right? Advertisers are not just assuming a woman could be easily duped by pretty shiny things. And this was a real belief in the sort of late 19th century, turn of the century, you know, early 20th century. And you just read the work of somebody like Paul Lerner, who's written about department stores in Germany, in the imperial period. And, you know, you get this really clear sense that, you know, there was great fear that, you know, women who go into these stores are basically just overcome by their excitement about these goods, that they will just buy anything, that they'll even steal. He has done a fair amount of work on sort of petty theft. And that this was all thought to be, you know, women's irrationality. right? That women could not make rational decisions when confronted with, you know, beautiful things. But by the 1920s and 30s, I think that changes a bit. And companies and their advertisers are becoming a bit more conscious of the need to approach women and see women, female shoppers, as rational beings, which sounds, I suppose, silly to us, but it's true. And so there is a greater sense of, you know, well, that's why we want to get women in to the sales staff, because, you know, female shoppers will, you know, trust them. They will listen to their arguments. They will understand, you know, they will both, you know what the importance of a certain product is and trust each other. And we also see companies, you know, doing surveys of consumers because they want their opinions. We see some big brands putting out, you know, newsletters for loyal customers where they talk about upcoming, you know, products, or they ask for feedback about existing products. So they are starting to do a bit more marketing in that sense, you know, thinking about their market and really believing that their market had, by market, these female consumers, you know, really had important beliefs and experiences that they needed to respond to. So they're, I do think there is a shift here in this period to seeing women, female consumers, as rational. And so does that fit with the Nazi view of women? I don't know, it probably depended, you know, which National Socialist you asked. I mean, I think that although, you know, there's this sort of simplified version of what women should be for the Third Reich, and that is, you know, mothers and wives. They too had a role to play, right, as mothers and wives, and it wasn't just as birthing machines, but as, you know, women who could create a certain type of culture at home and, you know, raise certain types of children. And you know, you do need to be a rational being to do that. They're trusting women to be able to do that the correct way, according to their ideology, right? To teach them about race, to teach them about, you know, who they should marry, who they should do business with, even, right? So, I think it does fit, but I have a more balanced view of what I think Nazis actually thought of women, right? And which does include some element of sort of rational behavior.
No, I think it's an important thing that you bring up, that, you know, the Nazi view of women isn't as simplistic as, you know, they were just meant to be in the home raising children. So I think the balanced approach is probably more useful way to think about it. So the advertisements themselves, the picture, the book is full of pictures. So I want to talk a little bit about the advertising themselves.
Okay.
Still continuing on this theme of women, were the ads themselves, when they were conceived, were they primarily still targeting women? Were they ads that were meant to appeal to women or children? And how much did advertisers really think about men?
Right. Well, I do think that they tended to be, I mean, it would obviously, to some extent, depend on the product. But even, you know, men's clothing and such, I think often was, you know, ads were often, you know, designed for the woman in his life who would be maybe making that purchase. You know, ads for, you know, heavy industry companies, right? Because steel manufacturers and, you know, the makers of airplanes and automotives and all that, those were probably more geared toward men, because it would be maybe men in businesses who are making purchases for their companies, you know, buying, you know, tools or buying machinery, all that kind of thing. That probably was not, those ads probably were not drawn for women, right? They were probably drawn for men in those industries themselves who would be, you know, making deals and making purchases. But in terms of consumer goods, I think men are not really taken into consideration that much. And in terms of children, yeah, we do see ads for children. We have as I was saying, they're coming out. Some of the big companies, big consumer goods manufacturers and retailers are coming out with, say, newsletters for women to kind of develop brand loyalty and to actually gain some feedback from women and to learn what they want and what they need. There's also an effort in this period to, and it starts before, it's not a Nazi invention, it's just a, you know, an early 20th century invention, to appeal more directly to children. And so we see more sort of brand-related, logos that might be attractive to children, little characters associated with certain brands that, you know, might be attractive to children. And as well, you know, little magazines, things like that. So they are usually separate from the ones for the moms. But yeah, we do start to see a little bit of this, brand development. But it's very new, and so it's not that widespread. One I can think of is the Salamander shoe manufacturer and retailer. They also had, branch stores all over the country. They had a little kids magazine that featured their Salamander character, and, with puzzles and, little short stories and things like that. So to try to develop throughout the family a sense of interest and loyalty to the brand.
You mentioned also in your introduction something I wanted to ask you about again. You mentioned the international sort of flavor of advertising that they were, sort of come over from the United States and Great Britain. And during the Nazi period, did this sort of international cooperation, did this hold until the war broke out? But say in the mid-30s, did it continue?
That's a good question. To some extent, it does. There is still some communication across borders through the mid-1930s. But those American and British agencies that I mentioned who come over in the 1920s and set up offices, they all leave, not, as you might expect, say in 33 or 34 because of the changing political climate in Nazi Germany, but they actually leave in 31, 32 because of the Depression. So they basically, it's very expensive to have an international office. Obviously the United States was suffering Depression and the UK was as well. So, and all their German clients have dried up. So they retract and all of those, non-German firms leave in the Depression during the early 30s before Hitler comes to power. In the mid-1930s, there is still a fair amount of travel among corporate leaders and among their advertisers and communications back and forth. But what we do see is still a bit of a change. Although they are talking and interested in what's going on in other countries, the advertisers within Nazi Germany are being told by the Ad Council, encouraged, I should say, right, because it's not necessarily this coercive direct coercion, but they are being encouraged to think of German ads as German ads, right? That there should be a certain look to them that is, homegrown, right? So that they can certainly, travel and think about what other countries are doing, but, Germany should have German-looking ads. So there is an encouragement towards the use of the sort of fracture, Gothic typefaces, right, that you always see on Nazi books, right? The kind of very angular typeface. There's an encouragement to use that. In the 1920s, basically ads had, because of this international spirit, had become, they had chosen typefaces that were, kind of like what we think of when we think of sort of Bauhaus looking sort of typeface, right? So sans serif, very clean and international, right? You can't really place it as German or not. So now in the mid-1930s, they're saying, let's go back to what we think of at least as kind of traditional German typeface. And it does increase in use. There's no law about it. You don't have to. And it's not everywhere, right? Not all ads are written in that typeface, but we do see an increase in it. And I think, again, that's because, you know, companies want to look like they're in the moment. They don't want to look out of date or out of step. And so there's this desire to try to fit in, and so companies are using it. It actually drops off again by, like, in the war years, and a lot of companies go back to that kind of international typeface, which is interesting. But yeah, so no, there is still communication until the war begins. And another actually interesting development is that in the mid-1930s, we see more in the sort of the professional journals of advertisers in Germany. We see stories about advertising in other countries, but they're differentiating. They're saying, this is the way the Swedes do it. And you can see by their artwork, or you can see by their text, that's a Swedish style. And this is the way the French do it. They are always very critical of the French. They said the French graphics were too chaotic and not orderly. And, they didn't like those. They were always, most of the articles were fairly negative about the French. But there was this desire in the mid-1930s, although they're still looking outward and kind of talking about what they see, to differentiate. This is an Italian style. This is a German style. This is a French style. There's not so much of a, you know, international style.
So we're through the 30s, and so now the war is going to begin.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could just talk just a little bit about the nature of the industry during the war.
Right.
Did they become sort of more patriotic, or did they just still market their consumer goods in the way they had been doing in the 30s and sort of left the war, pretend like the war wasn't going on?
Right, yeah. Well, in 1939, when the war breaks out, that defensive spirit I talked about in the sort of early 30s during the Depression, that returns, because in 1939, into 1940, when the war gets going, there is a push. There are some people in various state ministries who say we should actually put a halt on all advertising, that it's a waste of resources, it's a waste of paper, it's a waste of, you know, manpower, that we don't need it, right? It's not appropriate for the war, right? This is a serious time in Germany's, you know, history, to be advertising leisure products or, you know, new clothes or whatever. It's not appropriate. So advertisers, again, become very defensive, and we start to see advertisers and the companies who hire them, you know, saying, no, we need to hold on to advertising. It's important. And, in Goebbels, again, he could have weighed, you know, come in on either side of this argument. He actually, from what we can tell, you know, supported advertising continuing because it was part of daily life. It was part of what Germans thought of as normal living now, to have ads on the sides of buses and have ads in store windows and ads in, you know, magazines. And so if you removed all of that, you're really testing morale. That, you know, people would be freaked out. Like, that would be very strange. And you know, is that a sign that, you know, the apocalypse is coming, right? You want to keep people thinking everything is normal. And so although there were those who said we have to stop all advertising, the state and the ad council and business owners say no, it's important. And so it does continue, at least for through 1940 and about half of 1941, sort of through the summer of 1941, we don't see really any changes. We don't see a greater attention to patriotism, at least not significantly. Most companies are trying to sort of stick with status quo, right? That this is normal life. Everything is going to be okay. We should just all, you know, continue on as we've been doing. But by the sort of second half of 1941, we're starting to see a real decline in the availability of consumer goods products. And then the state has to respond, because now they have the problem of worrying about morale. If consumers expect to find certain goods on store shelves because they've seen an ad, say, for Nivea hand cream, and they say, oh, yes, I'm out of Nivea hand cream. I've just seen this ad and been reminded I need to buy some. And then they go to the store and there is no Nivea hand cream. then again, you're testing, you know, people's results. People start to be worried, you know, wait, why isn't there any? What does this mean? So in sort of late 41, we start to see the ad council, you know, making decisions about when it is appropriate to advertise and when it isn't. And there is a push to, and then legislation to end, you know, advertising for non, you know, war, necessities, you know, things that are not likely to be available because they're not necessary. And that's a lot of the consumer goods, like a lot of your daily use things. And so advertising does drop off after that, in the normal sense of advertising. What we get instead, what companies are still allowed to do, okay, so they're not allowed to advertise some product that they make that is no longer available, but what they can do is advertise their company. They can say, so for instance, Nivea hand cream is made by Beiersdorf, and Beiersdorf can still talk about their company as a good, loyal German company that has, you know, supported and helped German citizens for, you know, decades by producing, you know, goods that are of high quality, and that these goods will return in the future. So not to forget, you know, the importance of Beiersdorf as an innovator and friend of Germans. And so this is what companies are doing. They're creating these ads that are just talk about the sort of values of the company, right? That they are good nationalist, you know, supporters of the nation and employers of German men and women, and, you know, that kind of thing. And that their quality products will return down the road. And the companies like to do this because, of course, they can keep those brands and company in people's minds for when they do return. They won't have forgotten about them. And it's the only, you know, it's the only way they can advertise. So we do see quite a big shift sort of in the last couple of years of the war toward these sorts of ads that are called reminder ads. They just sort of remind you about the sort of values of the company. And of course, those values being in line with what the regime stands for. So we certainly see alignment there, in terms of, you know, the common good as being an important value, and hard work, and, you know, faith in the future and that kind of thing.
That's fascinating. As I said, that this is a fascinating project, and I would want to encourage all our listeners to go out and get the book and read it. So Dr. Swett, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before I let you go, we do like to ask one final question. If you could tell us a little bit about what you're working on now.
Well, since the book came out, I've just picked up a few, or sort of written a few short pieces, you know, chapters in books and journal articles on sort of related themes that kind of grew out of that project. So I've written a couple of things about savings banks in the 1930s and into the war years, and partly around the fact that historians have long known that because the regime was so worried about public opinion, they did not want to go to war bonds again, as they had in the First World War, to, you know, terrible results. They did not want to put, you know, new, very heavy taxes on individuals to raise money for the war effort either. So what they ended up doing is siphoning off people's savings accounts to fund the war. And Germans had amassed a lot of savings in the 1930s because, you know, by the mid-1930s, unemployment has practically disappeared, and so people are bringing in money, but there isn't a lot of stuff to buy, right, as this sort of preparation for war cuts down on the number of consumer goods available. So a lot of people are saving at high rates in the 1930s, and the German government is then using that money to pay for the war. And so what I've been trying to figure out, you know, what the ads were like for those savings banks. We might have expected, and there was one early article probably 20 years ago now, you know, that made the argument that ads for savings banks were all about sacrifice and the nation and the war. But in fact, a lot of the language that I found, not just in ads, but by officials who are trying to get people to save and that such, is that they are arguing that, you know, this is about people's personal goals and desires. It's not just the arguments around community and sacrifice. It's about saving for your own desires. And so I've been sort of thinking about that a bit. So I'm still working on it. But that's what's coming next.
Well, that sounds like a fascinating project. I hope I can have you back on the show when you finally write a book about it. I want to thank you again for being on the show today.
Sure.
I really enjoyed it. I also want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.